You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In March 1955, Albert Einstein wrote to the widow of a recently deceased friend, "For us believing physicists, the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion." Is time, as Einstein suggested, an illusion? That's just one of the questions tackled by Dan Falk in his new book called In Search of Time, The Science of a Curious Dimension. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and he joins me now to discuss that elusive fourth dimension. Dan Falk is a Canadian science writer and contributed to the CBC radio programs Ideas and Quirks and Quarks. Welcome to our show.
Thanks so much, Leonard. It is such a pleasure to be here.
What is time according to modern science? Is there a hard and fast definition that everyone can agree to?
Oh, it's funny because you would think there would be. You know, with all the advances of the 20th century and relativity and quantum theory, you'd think you could just open a textbook and read what time is. Almost 300 years earlier, Isaac Newton did try to write down a definition of time, but it turned out to be very problematic. He talked about time sort of chugging along at a steady pace. I think the best physicists can do now is to say time is what clocks measure. But a lot of people find that very unsatisfying. You know, they say, oh, well, yes, but I already knew that. And it's like they expect something more.
Well, the French philosopher Henri Bergson said that there's pure time and then there's mathematical time, the time that the clocks measure. And he tried to make a distinction between the two.
Well, I think...
Which led to Proust writing how many pages of a long novel.
Yes, and a cupcake-like pastry taking you back in time. I think so that does echo what Newton wrote so many years ago, but as I say, it did turn out to be a bit problematic. What Newton suggested that there is lurking in this background, this pure, he called it this mathematical time. He said it flows uniformly without reference to anything external. This is the famous definition at the front of his very big book, The Principia. And I think a lot of people, I don't know why, there's a lot of psychology at work, a lot of people seem to embrace that explanation or definition of time, that even though the clocks that we have are imperfect and, you know, clocks were developed to sort of mimic what sundials would do if they could do on cloudy days and at night, but even the sundials aren't perfect because the sun moves across the sky at a non-uniform rate depending on the time of the year and so on. And Isaac Newton understood all that, but he imagined, well, surely behind that, surely in the metaphysical background, there must be a kind of pure mathematical time. But the problem is modern physics has not found anything to confirm that.
Then the brain tells time, doesn't it? Because I know I pretty much wake up the same time every day. I don't know why that is. That's without an alarm.
Yes, it's interesting. And there are a lot of biological systems that are kind of like clocks, various rhythms. The biggest one is the circadian rhythm, various bodily cycles that ebb and flow on a roughly a 24-hour cycle, and there are many others in the natural world. And actually, we're just beginning to understand these. In my book, as I was writing In Search of Time, I discovered it is such a big topic. I probably could have written a whole separate book on, you know, the human experience of time and time in the biological world. What I had to settle for is, I do have a chapter on memory, which is something else we're just beginning to understand. So I mostly sort of talk about physics and philosophy and that side of thing. But you're absolutely right. The brain somehow is ordering events for us. We're somehow keeping track of what happened when and sort of building, you know, this picture of the world inside your head.
And you conducted a number of interviews in order to get a diversity of interpretations and understandings of time, mostly scientists and philosophers?
Yes, that's right. Physicists above all, just because, my own background is in physics, so I do admit that's sort of my prejudice. I'm quite a fan of modern physics, and I wanted to speak to the people who have spent, you know, decades investigating time and space. So people like Roger Penrose, David Deutsch, Julian Barber, those three happen to all be at Oxford, but also Paul Davies in Arizona and others. So, yeah, but I did, you know, I spoke to some philosophers, and I went to NYU and spoke to a psychologist there who
told me about, you know, memory of traumatic events and that sort of thing. So I try to get a diversity of opinions.
What are the earliest recorded timekeeping devices or methods?
Well, that's very interesting. You know, near the start of my book, I mention a very curious artifact from the Paleolithic era, the Old Stone Age. It's a bone from the wing of an eagle, and it has these funny little notches in it, and they're in rows, and it doesn't seem to be random at all. It seems to be a pattern of about 15 of these little notches on this bone, and then it sort of loops back and repeats. So you have multiple rows of 15, and the anthropologist who looked at it in the 1950s said, well, you know what? 2 times 15 is about 30. That's roughly the period of the lunar phases, one cycle from full moon or new moon to new moon. It's actually about 29 and a half, but pretty close. So this guy, Marshak, speculated maybe our Stone Age ancestors 30,000 years ago maybe were tracking phases of the moon. But more recently, of course, in ancient Egypt, they had sundials. These were commonplace. By the time we get to ancient Rome, sundials were everywhere, and a playwright named Plautus was actually lamenting that now we have sundials in the square, and you know they're all over the place, and they're chopping my day up into little pieces, and now I feel rushed all the time.
Well, do we have any theories as to why people started keeping time? I would assume that it came with the development of agriculture, but you're talking about people who are pre-agricultural.
In the case of that Stone Age artifact, that's right. And so, all, you know, of course, we can't get inside the heads of these, you know, our ancestors in the old Stone Age so many thousands of years ago. All we can do is speculate and that, say, they were probably looking up at the sky. Presumably, they were captivated by what they saw, the regular rhythms, the regular cycles, the daily rising and setting of the sun, the moon going through its monthly phases, and the seasons in their annual cycle. And as you suggest, of course, agriculture, by the time the first farming communities crop up in the Nile Valley and elsewhere, of course, precision timekeeping, at least to the extent of knowing, you know, when was the right time to harvest, when the Nile was going to flood, of course, was a very strong motivator for having a good calendar system. And so it's no surprise that the Egyptians and the Mayas in Central America and really everywhere where there was a civilization blossoming, there was also a calendar system being developed.
In fact, the Mayans seem to have based their whole culture on time. So much of their writing, so much of their buildings are all based on understanding the stars and being able to keep accurate time.
Yes, and I think one of the most two things I want to say about the Maya. First is that depending on how you measure it, you could actually say their calendar was more sophisticated than the Gregorian calendar that we use today in terms of the accuracy of keeping track of the cycles. However, the other thing that's very interesting about the Maya is that it was a very organic conception of time. So very much the opposite of, you know, interestingly enough, what Newton had said about time chugging away. For the Maya, every person was sort of involved in sort of keeping the cosmic harmony, and the king, who being at the top of the, you know, top of the food chain, had this very important role in keeping things harmonious. So there's this speculation that, you know, when a dynasty changes and when an empire, you know, when there's a transition in political power, that it parallels something that was going on in the cosmos, that one of these grand cycles coming to an end, that sort of thing.
Well, you write about the differences in the ways that different cultures perceive time today. For example, you say that Switzerland and Germany and Japan and Ireland are among the most fast-paced countries in the world, while El Salvador, which is close to where the Maya used to be, and Indonesia are among the slowest. Does this grow out of something else, or is this simply because we're talking about industrialized countries as opposed to less developed countries?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't know that we have clear-cut answers to that. The anthropologist who did that survey that led to that list of countries that you just mentioned, a fellow named Levine in California, and he ended up writing a book about it. But there is for sure this parallel that these countries with very strong Western-style economies also have this very fast pace of life, according to the various ways he measured it, and poorer countries with very, in some cases, almost no economy at all also have this very slow pace of life. He more or less just points that out as a statement of fact.
But he didn't include the United States and Canada in the top group.
And they're on the list of fast-paced, yeah, but not at the very top, but they are up there. Yeah, it's funny. And I think, you know, it's funny, New York wasn't as – I forget that he also ranked cities within the United States, and New York was high up, but wasn't right at the very top, though. I think Rochester was higher, right? Yeah, at any rate.
That's why I live in New York City. Dan Falk is here. His latest book is called In Search of Time, The Science of a Curious Dimension, published by Thomas Dunn Books Imprint, which is a division of St. Martin's Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Dan Falk, who is a science writer, has written for most of the major Canadian publications, and also has done shows on the CBC. He's written a book called In Search of Time, The Science of a Curious Dimension. It is published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. We were talking about agriculture. What about religion? To what extent has religion shaped the way we understand time?
Well, it's interesting that, in let's say, for example, Europe in the Middle Ages, religion was such a fundamental part of the way everyone thought about everything that it's not so surprising that it also encompassed the way we think about time. It has often been said that, you know, the rise of science, the sense of progress, that sort of thing, actually comes from a conception of linear time. If we think back to more ancient cultures, before the Judeo-Christian religions came along, we think of so many cultures that had cyclic pictures of time. But if you think of time as a cycle, you don't really think of, you know, how do you know the next cycle is going to be any different from this one? Chances are you don't. Chances are you think it's just going to be, you know, another harvest, another series of births and deaths and weddings and so on, and it's all just sort of the same. But with in Judaism, and later latched onto by Christianity and Islam, we have this idea of a single creation event, a unique event, with everything unfolding once, you know, the flood and, you know, the ark and now the where we are today, and then a final judgment, whatever. I mean, different religions, of course, differ on picture of what's going to happen next. But it's this linear idea of time that some historians have, you know, suggested leads to this more scientific outlook where you think there can be progress. Tomorrow doesn't have to be the same as today. So there's that kind of fundamental link. Not to mention, by the way, things like the Christian church being this motivator for developing a calendar by calculating the date of Easter, the most important Christian holiday, and a very difficult problem in timekeeping to try to figure out when one ought to celebrate Easter.
And we even have our calendars set according to at least what people thought was the year of Jesus's birth, and we are now 2009 years after that, although that's probably unlikely.
And of course we probably had that date off by 4 or 5 years on when Jesus was born. But having said that, the Gregorian calendar worked out quite, you know, in arduous detail by some clerics appointed by Gregory the 13th, is such a successful calendar. One of the things I mentioned in the book, and, you know, I hope it doesn't offend Catholics. I don't intend it to cause any offense. But I suspect that the Gregorian calendar is so incredibly successful that it will probably outlive all the religions on the planet today, including the one that gave rise to it.
Now, you mentioned the end of time. Most religions start time at a certain point and end at a certain point. But isn't time infinite, or are there scientists who believe that there can be an end to time?
Well, isn't that interesting? Because religion, of course, had the head start on this. There were stories of end times in all the major religions. Everyone has it. Even, you know, fans of Douglas Adams and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy kind of make fun of it with the universe being sneezed out of the nose of the great green arcle seizure, and then they fear the coming of the white handkerchief or something like that. So it's in all religions, and it's been discussed endlessly. But science, until recently, hasn't had that much to say. Until the 20th century, didn't have that much to say about the end of the world. But now that we know we live in an expanding universe, the investigation has really begun. And for a while in the 20th century, physicists were debating, is there enough mass in the universe to slow the expansion down so that everything will eventually re-collapse into something we might call a big crunch, or is the universe going to expand forever?
And what we found in the 1990s was, in fact, not only is the universe expanding, but it's also accelerating. There's this mysterious stuff which we call dark energy, for lack of a better term, and it's pushing everything apart. It seems now that the universe is just going to keep expanding forever. So in one of my chapters in the book, I talk about, you know, the ramifications of that, how the universe will get colder, darker, less hospitable to life. Of course, we're talking about, you know, billions upon billions of years, but it does seem like we're heading for a dark, cold future.
A listener, Simeon in West Orange, New Jersey, left a comment on our show page. He asks, how would one tell time should we start to explore the galaxy? Do we use the Earth as the reference point or somewhere else?
What an excellent question. I'd like to use this as a segue. Because
he's asking about absolute time. Is there
right.
such a thing?
And I think, unfortunately, we really finally do have to give that up. I mean, I suppose you could have a watch that you set back home and you could consult it from time to time if you wanted to, but you'd have no reason to. Communications with Earth would take, you know, let's say you're on the other side of the galaxy, then it would be many tens of thousands of years to send a message each way to Earth. You'd have no particular reason to keep Earth time. And I think what we're left is, sure, you pick a clock, you use it, and you can have turn over the pages on your calendar depending on what your clock says, but every person has really got to rely on their own clock. And in a nutshell, that is the end result of Einstein's revolution, that you have your own local time, you keep a clock, and if you want, you can measure how long events here and there in the universe take. But don't expect your friends in other places and traveling at high speeds to agree. We're going to have disagreements as to, you know, how long events take and what time something happened at, and really you just have to go with your own clock in Einstein's world.
But in that quote that I began this segment with, Einstein went further. He said that the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion.
What a powerful quote, yes. And, you know, to what extent he was being metaphorical or not, we can debate. This is something that he says towards the end of his life. And in another conversation with a philosopher named Carnap, he also laments the disappearance of the now. He says the idea of the now is something that means something very important and very, very personal to the individual, but just doesn't seem to be there in physics. It seems to be a concept that somehow lies beyond physics. So this question of time being an illusion, and I devote my whole final chapter is on this question, because it's just there's so much that one can say on it. Physicists cannot go quite so far as to say time itself is an illusion, although I did talk to, for example, Julian Barber in Oxford, who does hold that opinion, and I had quite a conversation, or we might say argument, with him about it. It's kind of funny because he denies the existence of time, but he was still able to meet me at the train station at the appointed hour. But even in
considering the British Railways, it was interesting that you actually met him at the
time. It did all work out. But even in even if you say, all right, Julian Barber is maybe a bit of a radical, but what's the mainstream position in physics? It is still something like, okay, there are different moments, there are different points in space and time, which are connected in this continuum of space-time, but the flowing, you know, physics can't say anything about this alleged flow that takes the future and makes it into the present, or takes the present and makes it into the past. We are left, maybe, with having to ask psychologists or philosophers or maybe even linguists as to why it is that we experience that flow.
Had there been much questioning between the time of Newton and Einstein? Were there reasons other than the fact that Einstein just came up with these incredible theories that would have led others to question the Newtonian concept of time?
Well, initially, no, there weren't, because Newton's laws are so incredibly successful. As long as you don't have a really egregiously strong gravitational field, and as long as you're not traveling at close to the speed of light, you don't need Einstein's revolution. So the laws of motion that Newton laid out in his Principia worked so well for 200 years. But as the 20th century started, we started, you know, sending radio signals and synchronizing clocks and investigating electricity and magnetism, thanks to James Clerk Maxwell. And as it all sort of came together, the shortcomings, the flaws in Newton's framework revealed themselves. And this is where Einstein comes into the picture. And you know, really changed everything that we thought we knew about space and time.
And we've had any number of books on the subject. We had Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time,
yes,
which has been described as the best-selling book that nobody ever completed.
Yeah.
But did you have problems with that book?
It is, you know, it's a tough read in places. I would say actually not as tough, for example, as Brian Greene's Elegant Universe, which really has some quite technical stuff about string theory and that in it. I made it through A Brief History of Time. I've read it a couple of times. But, you know, when he starts talking about imaginary time and, you know, parody, and there's some tough material in there. He was careful not to use a lot of equations, and I've been careful in my book. I really just have, I think, like one or two equations in the whole book, including, yes, obviously, E=mc². Hawking, he's a good writer, and it flows pretty well, but there are some tough concepts in it. I can't argue with that. And anytime, you know, I struggled. I have a chapter on, you know, introducing relativity, and I have a whole chapter on time travel. There's a lot of nuance in there, and it is quite a challenge to write that sort of thing for a general audience.
Another book that came out recently, Christopher Dewdney's Soul of the World, Unlocking the Secrets of Time. It's interesting that he has been assigned reviews of your book. Is there rivalry in this area?
Oh, that's funny. You know, at first, when I heard that his book was coming out, and mine was in the final stages of editing, right? So there was, you know, it's too late to make any changes, even if I had wanted to. But I thought, all right, well, he's known primarily for being a poet. So I thought, all right, his book will be poetic and mine will be a little more scientific. So, and as I read his book, I thought, yeah, that, you know, basically that is his approach. So I didn't feel too put off by it. But it's funny that he does get, you know, I don't want to say anything bad about him, but he does get a few things wrong. Like the letter that you mentioned that Einstein wrote to the widow of a colleague, I mean, he actually gets the name wrong. He says he wrote it to the widow of Hermann Weyl, but actually Hermann Weyl was still alive. He actually outlived Einstein. So the letter was actually sent to Mikhail Besso. Anyway, little things like that. But no, Christopher Dewdney, I went to his book launch. He's a fine fellow.
It is interesting that in the end, we still pretty much live in Newtonian time, don't we? Because you say it works?
I think so. I think, you know, when I give...
What would happen if we were living in Einsteinian time? What would my clock look like?
Well, so, of course, the thing is, I mean, we do live in Einstein's world, but we just don't notice it because we're moving around at slow speeds. And, you know, we live on the Earth where the gravity is quite mild. If we lived closer to the edge of a black hole, of course, we would notice clocks disagreeing with each other in a more vigorous way. But I think it's because, you know, it's true. We do imagine that Newton was right. I mean, Einstein showed that Newton was wrong, but I think in our minds, because of the way we experience time, we have this affinity for that old definition from 300 years ago that time flows by. And when I give public talks and lectures, people still bristle. You know, I give my little PowerPoint thing, little introduction to Einstein, and people still bristle about, you know, how I explain how twins, you know, the twin paradox, and how twins can actually end up not being the same age if one of them goes on a little journey and then comes back. Say, oh, but how can that be? And, you know, the time that it takes, how is that possible? And so there is, people have such a resistance, even 100 years now, 110 years after special relativity, and people just, I don't know what it is. They just have a hard time wrapping their heads around Einstein's revolution, even though it's, you know, it's passed test after test after test. I like to remind people that if they've ever used a GPS device of any kind, those systems actually wouldn't work. You know, GPS devices send signals back and forth to a network of satellites with very exquisitely timed out signals. And in fact, the people who program the software for GPS devices have to take into account special relativity and general relativity, the two parts of Einstein's theory. And if they didn't, the results would actually be off by, like, you know, 100 yards, and you could crash your boat or your plane or something. So you know, Einstein was right, but it's just funny. We have such a hard time wrapping our heads around it.
Now, just one more thing. I'm unlikely to be anywhere near a black hole. At least I hope I won't be. But why would a black hole screw up clocks? Why would it make them all show different times?
Well, this is from the second part of Einstein's theory, general relativity, which is his theory of gravity. And the prediction is that in strong gravitational fields, time runs slower. And that's just the way it is. And if you know, we often say that wouldn't it be horrible to fall into a black hole because you'll be crushed into spaghetti as you approach the
the singularity at the heart of the black hole. Well, that's true from your point of view as you fall into the black hole. But it's funny because your mom and dad watching from the sidelines do not see that happening. Because of the time dilation effect, they see you getting closer and closer to the edge of the black hole, but never quite crossing it. They see you hovering for all eternity with your watch stopped at the edge of the black hole. So, you know, that's funny. You experience a painful, agonizing death, but your family never gets to hold a funeral because they see you still hovering at the edge of it.
That's very reassuring, Dan. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dan Falk. Appreciate it.
His book, In Search of Time, The Science of a Curious Dimension, is published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much.